Will you please welcome Dr. Jay Richards?
Well, it is really great to be with you. And Dick and I actually, we've been, yep, it's going to work. Okay, no, you don't have to sing a tune for us. We'll actually do it. We started talking actually about a year ago, and we had just driven through Billings. So I lived, my family and I lived in Seattle for most of the last, I don't know, 10 or 12 years, since 1998, and moved to Washington, D.C. just about exactly a year ago. And so we drove through here, and we had been in Billings, and I mean, literally just driven through here, gotten to our new house in the D.C. area, and I got an email from a guy in Billings that said, hey, you know, would you come to Montana? And I had never spoken that I know of in Montana, in this massive state. And this is one of the things that frustrated me about Seattle, is that when you live in Seattle and you're a speaker, you get invited places, and it's almost never Montana, Wyoming, or Idaho, or Oregon. And so you fly over all these massive western states. And I always thought, you know, it'd be nice if I could visit some of these places, actually. So I said, absolutely, let's work it out. But I'd prefer not to come in the middle of winter, if possible. So that's why we're here in September. I've heard tale of some of these things. So, okay, this didn't actually show on, but that was my fault. So let me pull it up. But what I want to do, actually, tonight and this morning and is I'm going to focus on sort of economic ideas. And because it's a worldview conference, I want to tie this in a bit to the Christian worldview, because you might think, okay, well, economics, maybe it's important, but I don't exactly see what it has to do with the Christian worldview. And it's a bit complicated, because if you're a Christian, you might say, well, okay, so the Bible is the revealed word of God written. Is everything about economics, should we as Christians discover all of those things in the Bible? Is that what it means to sort of have a Christian worldview with respect to economics? Like, for instance, could you discover Ricardo's law of comparative advantage, right, or the price function, or the relationship between supply and demand? Is that in the text of Scripture somewhere? Think about it in another subject. Could you learn all of the laws and principles of chemistry from the Bible, like the periodic table? Well, you know, now that one's sort of obvious. You know, no, there's something going on. What's going on is that God has revealed himself in two primary ways, and when they're interpreted properly, they both reconcile with each other, but they also mutually interpret each other. So they tell us different things about the world around us. So God has created a world, as Psalm 19 says, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Paul says in Romans 1, from the foundation of the world, God's invisible qualities and eternal power have been clearly seen from the things that have been made. And so what's been said in the long sort of course of Christian history and Christian theology is that God has two primary books, two ways in which he reveals himself. And you might think I'm talking about the Old and the New Testaments, but what it is, it's the book of nature and the book of Scripture. The book of nature, it's tempting to not think of it this way, but the Christian theology has always said that it has a revelatory quality. That's what the Bible tells us that. It's not, God didn't create a world that's silent to his existence. But the world reveals God in a different and more general way. So you know that Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. God, in that first verse of Psalm 19:1, the Hebrew word is the word El, which is the generic word for God. It's like the word God in English, or creator. It's not a uniquely Hebrew word. It's the word that everybody used for the deity in the ancient Near East. If you keep reading the psalm, you get down to the second half of Psalm 19, and it moves from talking about the created order to talking about the law of the Lord. And the first verse is, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. Read the rest of the chapter. You hear Lord seven times. So you get El, God the creator, when we're talking about the creation in the heavens, and Lord in the last half of the psalm when it's, the psalmist is talking about the law. Now, what's going on? Well, Lord, if you look, depending on the biblical translation, is usually in small caps, which means they're all capital letters, a big L and then the O-R-D. What that is that means that in the Hebrew, the word is Yahweh. So in other words, the word is God's personal name. So what's the point? The point is that God, in his created order, reveals himself generally as creator. And this is what the American founders thought. They thought that just from reason, from studying the world around us, from studying the starry heavens above and the moral law within, we could infer to the existence of a creator. Now, we're not going to know his name is Yahweh. We're not going to know about the Trinity. We're not going to know about what God has done in history, but we'll know there's a God, right? And so the created order, nature, if properly interpreted, is a revelation of God. It's not a special revelation. Special revelation is when God acts directly in history. Right? The psalmist and the Hebrews would not have known the name of God unless God told them their name, right? You might be able to figure out there's a creator. You don't know what God that creator's name is unless he tells you. That's the difference between special and general revelation. Now, why am I telling you that? Well, I think it's absolutely important when you're talking about Christian worldview to get that clear. Think of that as God's revelatory economy. The way in which he has chosen to reveal himself is that he has created a natural world that glorifies and testifies to his existence at all times and places. Day after day, they pour forth speech, as the psalm says. Then he's also chosen to break into that created order that is both that he, of which he is the creator and of which it has been testifying. So think of God acting in history as an actor in a stage play. So if you go to at least a really good stage play, a really high production value play, you get these amazing sets, right? And those are in the background. And they tell you the context of the actors. And so when the actors are doing stuff in the foreground, you know what's going on in part because you know, well, are they inside their living room? Are they in a back alley? That's God's general revelation. It's the context in which he acts in the foreground in history. Why is that important for economics? I know most of you are going, what? Oh, we've wandered into Psalms and Hebrew. And okay, here's why it matters. Because if you don't have that category as a Christian, if you think, well, you know, you can't have any knowledge that's not directly derived from Scripture. And you know intuitively there's a bunch of stuff you learn from other places. You know, all that chemistry you learned. Remember the periodic table? You memorized it in the 7th grade, forgot it in the 8th grade. That was all discovered by people studying the book of nature very carefully. And that's not a challenge to God's sovereignty or to the specialness of Scripture. It's how God's chosen to reveal himself. It's the same thing in economics. There are a lot of economic truths in Scripture. And if you read this book, Money, Greed, and God, that Dick referred to, I talk about that, about ideas specifically that come from Christian theology that help make sense of what we've discovered in economics. But there is a bunch of stuff that you still discover in the economic realm. It's part of God's book of nature. And so there's basic laws and principles and rules and things that you discover from studying economic systems. There are things we know now that weren't well understood a century ago or 5 centuries ago or 1,000 years ago. And so the way I would sort of describe this is that when we're developing a Christian worldview, what we want to do is figure out how to integrate all those things that we've learned from the book of nature with the book of Scripture, with the kind of principles of Christian theology. So here's how I would describe it. Because what we don't want to integrate is economic ideologies. People very often get this confused. They think, well, there's all these kind of competing ideologies, and there's Ludwig von Mises, and there's John Maynard Keynes, and Karl Marx, and Ayn Rand. And so they'll think that all economics is a bunch of competing ideologies. But we wouldn't think that about other fields. For instance, biology, right? Even though the Darwinian ideology very often works its way into biology as a discipline, we know there's a difference between Darwinian theory and basic discoveries from biology. Right? Well, then we want to do the same thing in economics. So what we want to do is integrate what I'm going to call the descriptive truths of economics. That is, those things that describe truths we've discovered in the economic realm and the theoretical insights. There are insights that you say, okay, how is it? This was a conundrum. This was a mystery for centuries. Why is it that something like a diamond, which no one actually needs, right? I mean, you might need it for some modern tools, but for most of history, people didn't need diamonds. Why is it that a little tiny diamond can be exquisitely expensive, but a glass of water that if you don't have for 3 days, you're dead, is free in a lot of places, right? It's free here. Why is that? Something we all need is free, and something nobody needs is extremely expensive. Well, there was a theoretical insight, I'm not going to get into it, called the subjective theory of economic value that explains that. And people didn't understand it for centuries. They thought, well, something is worth just as much as it costs to produce it. And that leads to all sorts of weird kind of results. That means that two guys building houses side by side could build houses that look exactly alike, you know, have the same sort of materials. And yet one guy, because he was really slow and had to use 10 people to build it, whereas the other guy was able to use 3 workers and build it in half the time. If things were worth just how much it cost to produce it, the house that was slower to build would be worth more than the other. Right? So you see how these theoretical assumptions, they help us to understand reality. So what you're always dealing with when you're studying nature, whether it's biology or economics or what psychology, is this interaction of insights that help us explain things and then discoveries, right? It's sort of interacting. And so that's the stuff we get from the book of nature. And then we want to integrate those with the principles of theology and the relevant truths of theology. I'm just glad that's not my phone. That has happened before. That's what we want to do, all right? So it's not simply a matter of saying, well, we're just going to get theology from the Bible, we'll get economics from nature. It's more complicated than that because there's economic principles in Scripture, but we should expect that there are going to be a lot of things that we learn that we don't get from one or the other. Well, I didn't understand any of this. And in fact, if you read Money, Greed, and God, I don't even quite put the point that way in this book. But if you're thinking about the Christian worldview, I think this is the way you ought to think about economics, is that you have to figure out a way to integrate all these things we've discovered, all these insights from the economic realm, with the fundamental principles of the Christian worldview that we get from Scripture and theology. And that's not easy to do. That sounds scary. The good news is that most of the things that we need to know and understand about economics, we can learn, you can learn, without ever actually studying the economic discipline. That is, there's a technical discipline of economics. It is, in a sense, a science in certain ways that you can study in school. Most people, if they had a course in college, it was called macroeconomics. How many of you had that macroeconomics course in college? Most people that have that course never take another course because they had macroeconomics. That's what it's for. It's to alienate people. You often don't get the sort of interesting stuff. You find out later that you've studied Keynesian policy rather than economics. They don't tell you that. And so most of what you actually need to learn about economics, the important stuff, you can actually learn without studying economics as a discipline. But I didn't understand this in college. I went to a small liberal arts school in South Texas. I'd grown up in a Presbyterian church and thought of myself as a Christian, but not especially well-developed intellectually. So got off to college, it was very liberal, it was in the 1980s, and the first book I read in a political science course was called The Communist Manifesto by a guy named Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. It's a little book, you can read it in about 45 minutes. And so to a freshman in college that's first being exposed, and it's hard to describe, it's like intellectual porn. That's the only way I can describe it. It's like, I can't believe it, it's just so bracing, and you read it, and it seems exciting, it seems to make sense of things, and it's passionate. It's just precisely the sort of thing you'd give to an unhinged freshman in college. And I thought my professor had said if we read the textbook 5 times that semester, we would automatically get an A. And so I did. I read that book. I read the other book, which was by an American socialist. And by the end of my freshman year, I thought Christians ought to be socialists. And it's a kind of convoluted story, but that was actually my conviction in my freshman year in the 1980s. And it turns out the professor had said, if you read the books 5 times through, you're bound to get an A. That's what he actually said. It worked out in my case, but I thought, oh, this is an automatic deal. The book's short. This will be easy. As a result, it got into my head, and so I languished with these really bad economic ideas in my head for a few years. Nevertheless, I kept reading, and so I stumbled upon a book by an economist named Thomas Sowell. Had written a book on Marxism that I read, and by the time I was about a senior in college, I had actually worked my way around to becoming convinced that that communism and socialism just made absolutely no sense and clearly wouldn't work economically. And moreover, that what we might call free enterprise, or capitalism perhaps, is actually, of the live alternatives economically, the best available alternative. Well, so I sort of resolved that intellectually, but one other thing had happened to me is I had read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand my senior year. It was during the time when I was supposed to be studying for a German final. So, of course, I had to do something else. Somebody gave me Atlas Shrugged. And again, it's the kind of thing, it's like, wow, this is just fire. And she has an argument we'll talk about in a minute that is essentially that Christianity and capitalism are incompatible. That capitalism is based on greed and selfishness. And that we ought to embrace it. And so I had this intellectual roadblock. But I said, well, I think economically that free enterprise makes the most sense. But it's based on greed and selfishness, and so I don't kind of know how to resolve this. And so I graduated from college. You know, I was frustrated about it. I went off to graduate school. The Soviet Union collapses at this point. By the way, I had a course my junior year on Eastern European politics right before the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe collapsed. And the conclusion of the course was that the Eastern European and Soviet economies were just about as strong as the American economy. So I wish I could get my money back for that course now. You know, so, but what happened along the way is I started reading and I found two very important books. One called Wealth and Poverty by a guy named George Gilder, who is now a friend and a colleague of mine at Discovery Institute, and another man named Michael Novak at the American Enterprise Institute, who wrote a very important book called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism that actually influenced Pope John Paul II and the Solidarity Movement in Poland. And they made, George Gilder's case, it wasn't an explicitly Christian case, but he completely reinterpreted the capitalist system in a way that made it compatible, I thought, with the Christian worldview, and Michael Novak did it more or less explicitly. And so I, by the time I was in graduate school, felt like I had resolved these ideas intellectually, but it didn't matter. It was the 1990s. Everybody was talking a free market game. Bill Clinton was in the White House. He was talking about limited government and free markets. Everybody was. And so I thought, okay, that's finally one argument has been settled. You know, we can move on to something else. And so I wrote for years actually on science and faith issues and ended up on like Christian college campuses. And you know what I discovered, say 1999, 2000, 2001? College kids that all thought the same dumb stuff that I thought in the 1980s about economics. So all these things that I thought, well, that's been settled, had not been settled. And in fact, now when I speak on college campuses, I'm speaking to kids who have no memory of the Cold War, that were not alive during the Cold War. And I hate to tell you, but all the same bad arguments for socialism that, you know, seemed plausible to me before it had been shown to be such a failure are just as plausible and perhaps even more so popular, not just among college kids, but among Christian college kids on Christian college campuses. And so you might say the way I got into this issue now about 10 years ago was out of frustration more than anything else. It was driving me crazy that the same really basic insights were not getting through. And so I did some documentaries. I wrote this book, Money, Greed, and God. And the purpose of Money, Greed, and God was to, I told myself, I said, okay, what would I write if I had to say, here are the basic intellectual myths and misconceptions that people have that prevent them from thinking clearly about economics. Right? It's not going to be a book that looks like an economics textbook. It's not going to really sort of make the case. It's going to say, here are the myths that almost always bewitch people when they're thinking about these issues, and Christians in particular. And at first I thought, there are maybe 100 of these myths. This is going to be a very long and boring book. That was what I initially thought. But the longer I worked on it and talked to college kids, the more I realized that there are really just about 8. That most of the misconceptions, if you sort of whittle them down, end up being variations of 8 basic myths. And if you learn what those myths are, you learn to recognize them, and you understand what's wrong with them, I would argue that you have the basic tools you need to be able to think clearly about economic issues and to be able to think about economic policy rationally without ever having to go get an advanced degree in economics. And so that's really what the book is about. 8 chapters plus an intro and conclusion, and each of the 8 chapters is one myth and one question and an attempt to sort of work our way through it. So I can't, you know, I very rarely describe all 8 myths in one talk. I can actually talk very, very quickly, but it's not very pleasant. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you 4 examples of 4 myths. And Dick actually partially stole the argument for one, but I'll see if I can add a little more meat to it. So let's do that real quickly. These are myths that people believe in general, but I think Christians are actually very tempted by in particular. And the first is what I call the piety myth. The piety myth is called that because the piety has to do with the state of your heart, right? You're a pious person if your heart is right before God, and so it reflects how you act and how you sort of feel morally. Well, the piety myth is it's ignoring unintended consequences and trade-offs. Or to put it differently, it's confusing the good intentions in the state of your heart with the consequences of your actions. Now, this is really a temptation for Christians because we know that both the internal and the external matter, right? God cares both why we do something and what we do. If we do something that looks nice on the outside, but we do it for manipulative reasons, then that's not a good thing, right? If you give your wife a dozen roses, not a birthday, it's not your anniversary, just seems to be this random act of kindness, that looks like a nice thing to do. But what if, say, you've been on 3 hunting trips already that year and there's a 3-day weekend coming up and you're hoping to go on a 4th, she doesn't like you going on them at all and you're greasing the skids before you ask her, right? You see what's happened? The internal has transformed the sort of moral reality of that act. So in morality, both the internal and the external matter. In economics, there's a disconnect between those things. So the reason that a congressman or a congresswoman votes for a policy doesn't bear any connection to the effect of the policy. So you could have 535 members of Congress vote on a bill for 535 reasons. That bill is going to have the same effect no matter why they meant to do it. And if you can remember that, you can actually avoid the piety myth. That sounds simple, but it's as easy to get as it is easy to forget, unfortunately, because there's just a perennial temptation to focus on what we mean to do, right, rather than what actually happens as a result of our actions. It's this great book written in the 1950s by a guy named Henry Hazlitt. The book's called called Economics in One Lesson. And Hazlitt actually describes the art of economics in terms of essentially avoiding the piety myth. Here's what he says. He said, the art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. In other words, for every policy that somebody proposes, let's raise the federal minimum wage to $100 an hour and then we'll all be rich. You might say, well, that sounds nice. I know you mean well, but then what will happen, right? And you wait and actually think through and talk through what will happen. That's the art of economics. Not that complicated, but I've often called this the trillion-dollar question, and then what would happen? Because if Congress people would just ask that question before they enact policies, we might have saved trillions of dollars. That's essentially learning the piety myth. Now, I can give you lots and lots of examples. I spoke to a college in Florida on Monday, and the whole talk was about good intentions not being good enough, and all I did is give him depressing examples of the piety myth. Incidentally, I call this the piety myth from a quote by a 20th century French philosopher named Étienne Gilson, who said, piety is no substitute for technique. His point is that the state of your heart is not a substitute for technical knowledge and know-how of some particular field. When I lived in Seattle, there's Boeing engineers that had a men's group, and they're Christians. These are smart guys with PhDs in aeronautical engineering from places like MIT and Caltech. And so I would speak to this group, this is awesome, there are all these engineers at Boeing that are Christians. But it occurred to me, you know, I'm glad they're Christians, but just being Christians is actually not enough to know how to put a plane in the air, right? Just because they mean well, if they don't know about Bernoulli's principle and lift and things like that, you know, those planes are still going to crash. And so I'm glad they're Christians, but it's also very important that they have technique. That was Gilson's point. But we often confuse this. We decide who we're going to vote for and who we think means well based on what we think they mean to do. And if the politician that says, well, he cares about people. Really, what we ought to want is to say, well, I'd rather have a politician that hates people, it's bad for his soul, but does something that helps people, rather than somebody that loves his fellow man and manages to kill off millions of people because of bad policies, right? What you want to know when you're talking about policies is the actual effects. Let me give you just a couple of really quick examples of piety myth in action. One is rent control. This is my favorite. I'm sure you don't have rent control in Billings, but rent control is essentially it usually happens just for local cities, and they're very large cities, very popular in the 1970s. So what rent control is let's say you're in Manhattan in the 1970s, everybody looks around, you say, you know, the price of rental housing is going through the roof, and lower-income people are not going to be able to afford rental homes before long. And so city councils around the world thought, well, we'll solve that problem. We'll just put caps on the prices that landlords can charge for housing. So the idea would be, well, let's say we want to put the cap on one-bedroom apartments at $300 a month, right? And then people will continue to be able to afford these homes. Well, that sounds nice. Remember, if you're not going to fall for the piety myth, what would you say? And then what will happen, right? And you answer that question just by thinking about it from the perspective of the landlord. Because remember, if you're a landlord, let's say it costs you $800 a month just to maintain a property, and you can only charge $300 a month for the property. What's going to happen? What's going to happen is over time, there's actually going to be a shortage of the very housing that the city council is trying to preserve. Now, why is that? Well, think about, let's say that the cap is $300 on one-bedroom apartments. If you're a landlord, you're going to do one of three things. You're going to sell the property, so it's a condo. You're going to convert it to commercial property, so it's not rental property and won't be under the law. Or you're going to let it go to ruin because you can't afford to maintain it, and then you'll be a slumlord, and then it will eventually be condemned. So rent control, because it ignores the function of prices in a market, ends up creating a situation which it puts a shortage in the very thing that was intended to be preserved. So it does exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to be. That's that. Remember I said there are basic laws and principles in the economic realm? And politicians don't actually have jurisdiction over those things any more than they have jurisdiction over the law of gravity. It's just part of reality. So the question is whether you're going to set up policies that fit it or not. Give you one other example, and I don't know if any of you are at the Pachyderm Club at lunch today, but I talked about another book I wrote last year called Infiltrated about the financial crisis, and it can get kind of complicated really quickly. But what's interesting about the financial crisis is that most people think it was the result of free markets run amok, of unfettered capitalism. In fact, if you Google financial crisis and unfettered capitalism, you get thousands of hits because of this. The problem is that we all know, okay, well, the financial crisis had something to do with all of these so-called subprime mortgages, subprime loans that ended up in the system in 2008, and a lot of them started going bad, and so bad things happened on Wall Street and banks. That's what, kind of the level of what most people know. The problem is, if you just think for a minute about what a banker would actually do, you realize the story doesn't add up. So if you're a normal banker, let's say you've just got a family bank here in Billings, and you just it's just a family bank that you've inherited, and you give out loans for houses, mortgages. Somebody comes in, and they want a loan. Now think about in a normal market situation, right? So this is the free market, you know, unfettered. Are you going to want to give out a loan that's not likely to be paid back? Or you can give somebody a $500,000 loan and say, well, they don't really seem to have a credit rating, or what they do have is bad. They don't have any money for a down payment. They seem to have defaulted on several other loans that they had, and they tend to make their employers mad and get fired about every 2 weeks from every job they've ever had. So I think I'll give them $500,000 to buy a house, and I don't need to look to see if the house is worth $500,000. Right? That makes no sense. That's what would happen in a free market system, a normal market. What you're going to do as a banker is you're going to want to make sure that the borrower has skin in the game. So that's why you'd want 20% down payment. If they've given up $100,000 of their own money and they're going to lose it if they default on the loan, they're not probably going to default. You're going to want to make sure they're good for the money, make sure the house can be appraised so that it's good collateral. All these things you're going to do because you're in the business of giving out loans and hopefully getting them paid back with a little interest, right? Well, so if that's true, how is it possible that in 2008, one half of all the mortgages in the American market, 27 million loans, were subprime or risky loans that were loans that were given to people with low credit ratings, often given to people for 1 or 2 or 3% down payment, millions and millions of these loans? It makes no sense for sort of normal market purposes. In fact, in 2007, there were all these stories about so-called ninja loans. NINJA stands for no income, no job or assets, all right? So again, NINJA loans can't exist in a normal banking market that's unfettered, right? Just as a basic incentives. What had happened is that over decades, dozens of well-meaning policies called affordable housing goals had been imposed on banks, on Fannie Mae, who bought the loans from banks, in order to try to increase home ownership among lower income people. So a very, very well-meaning idea that was supported by both Republicans and Democrats. The effect of these policies, unfortunately, was ultimately to destroy and to degrade the basic underwriting standards that had always existed on loans. So we got millions and millions of these loans in the system that were then securitized and sold on the open market around the world. So as a result, you could have banks' loans default in Detroit that could lead to a little fishing village in Norway going bankrupt because they'd invested in those things. This is just a classic example of the piety myth in which well-intentioned policies were not thought through really well and led to a financial crisis. So it simply was not the result of unfettered capitalism. Well, that's a couple of examples. I won't give you any more. I could torture you all night with examples of good intentions run amok, but let's move on. The greed myth. Now, greed myth is, in some ways, it's kind of the most insidious myth because it's believed not just by critics of the market economy, but also by its champions. There was a movie in 1987 that I went and saw in college called Wall Street. The main character is played by Michael Douglas. The character's name is Gordon Gekko. Not really that subtle, obviously, but you get the idea. He's a stereotypical cigar-smoking Wall Street real estate broker and banker. And in the movie, he's a very brash sort of person. The movie, by the way, is made by Oliver Stone. And toward the end of the movie, he's in a conference room, and it's a stockholders meeting for this company. And he gets mad. He raises his hand. And he manages to get the microphone, and he gives this speech that's become classic in Hollywood. It's called the Greed is Good speech. And here's what he says. He says, greed is good. Greed is right. Greed cuts through and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms has marked the upward surge of mankind. Now, when you watch it, you think, wait, is this the climax? Am I supposed to be excited about this? Or it's just a weird kind of dissonant thing. But when you realize, okay, it's made by Oliver Stone, it's an obvious stereotype, you know, nobody would actually say this. The movie, by the way, had a sequel a couple of years ago that starts after the character Gordon Gekko gets out of prison. It literally starts, and then it's like his second life. And so you say, okay, well, that's the critics, right? The problem is, remember, there's the 20th century's leading advocate of capitalism, the most widely read advocate of capitalism, said something sort of like that. Ayn Rand was this exile that emigrated from the Soviet Union to the United States. 200,000 copies of Atlas Shrugged still sell every year. 200,000 copies. That's a huge number for a book. She wrote a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. All right. She had insisted for her whole life, she was a hardcore atheist, that capitalism and Christianity, capitalism and altruism is just acting on behalf of the other, were incompatible. That's what she said. Capitalism and altruism are incompatible. They're philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist in the same manner in the same society. Well, think about that as a Christian. Selfishness and greed, those are one of seven deadly sins. There's not a whole lot of good stuff written in the Bible about greed and selfishness. So if the economic system of capitalism is literally based on greed, that's a problem for Christians. And notice the argument's not whether greed exists, right? That's not the question. Of course greed exists. Get two or three people together. I mean, Adam Smith said, two men of commerce do not gather together, but that they conspire against their fellow man to, you know, to control prices or something. So that's not the question. The question is whether the system is based on greed, if that's its essence. Now, Rand said this, and this tripped me up for a few years because I hadn't studied widely enough to realize I don't think Rand got the system right. But a lot of people think Rand is just repeating something that was said by the great Scottish moral philosopher Adam Smith. Adam Smith was a Scottish thinker. Dick quoted him a little while ago, who wrote a book in 1776 called The Wealth of Nations. Didn't influence the founders for obvious reasons because this was happening sort of simultaneous with the founding. But it's from Adam Smith that we get this idea of a market acting as if by an invisible hand. And people often think that Smith made an argument like Rand, that selfishness and greed are good, and that if you really just let them go, they'll lead to these great things. So I want to show you the two most famous quotes of Smith, which what I discovered when I was working on this book is that most people have heard of Smith, most people have heard these two quotes of Smith, and almost no one has actually read Smith. And the reason is because The Wealth of Nations is long and tedious and talks about pin production in Scotland and, you know, kind of a lot of boring stuff. So I thought, maybe I'll actually read him. And what I discovered is that he was a very careful and thoughtful person. So I just want to show you two quotes from Smith. I want to convince you that what Smith was arguing was something much smarter, much more true, and quite different from what Ayn Rand argued. So here's the first one. Many of you might have heard this quote. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher or the brewer or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. So we don't expect the butcher to be visualizing world peace, but it doesn't really matter. It's from that they're acting on their self-interest and they provide us with dinner. Right, so hold that quote in your mind. The other is this reference to the invisible hand, which is constantly referenced. I could have only found two places in all the literature of Adam Smith where he actually uses it, but here's one. He's talking about men of commerce. He says, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, business people are led by an invisible hand, and thus without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interest of the society. So here's the question. Is Smith saying what Ayn Rand said? Is he saying that greed is good, that selfishness is a virtue, that the market economy is based on these things? No, he's not saying that at all, and I'll show you why. So there's a few kind of distinctions. So if you're wondering, when do we get to the most complicated part of the talk? It's right now, all right? So if you're starting to fade, just pull it together, and it gets really easy after this, I promise. Because to get this, and not to fall for the greed myth, you've got to see a couple of really important distinctions, all right? First thing is this. Smith was a moral philosopher. He was a moral traditionalist. He was probably a deist, was a neo-stoic. He was very much a traditionalist. He always treated greed and selfishness as vices, as bad things, as bad for your soul. He wrote a book prior to The Wealth of Nations called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. He was interested in how people develop sympathy for their fellow human beings. So the first thing to realize is that when Smith's talking about self-interest, that's not the same as talking about selfishness. If you can get this, you will understand this point better than probably 95% of the population. Every time you take a breath, every time you eat a meal, every time you look both ways before you cross the street or brush your teeth, or get 8 hours of sleep, or study hard for your final, or obey your parents, you're acting in your self-interest. Do you think, well, yeah, that's a necessary evil. I guess, you know, we got to live with that. No. You, as a parent, you spend 18 years trying to get your kids to understand this. It's actually in your self-interest and good for you to brush your teeth, right? It's crazy. They don't get this. They don't understand their basic self-interest, right? Certainly their long-term self-interest. God has made us as creatures, right? We're made of matter. We have to breathe. We have to eat. We have to sleep. We have to drink. And so there's a natural realm of our interests, those things that we regard, and we have some interest for and some interest in an ability to control. That's the realm of our self-interest that it's maybe morally neutral. It may even be morally good. It's appropriate that we attend to those things. In fact, the golden rule presupposes this, doesn't it? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What that means is that if you have a properly formed conscience, you can say, and that's crucial, right? If it's all whacked out, this isn't going to work. But if you have a properly formed conscience, you can determine how you're supposed to treat other people by saying, how should I be treated? Right? And that becomes a guide for how to treat others. That only makes sense if there is a legitimate realm of self-interest. It's okay, right? And so notice Smith's point back here. It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker, but from their regard to their own interests. He's not actually saying anything about selfishness here. His point is that in a market economy, what he called the natural system of liberty, so you've got the rule of law. This is not anarchy where everybody's getting to do what they want to do. The butcher can't steal from his neighbor, right? If he lies and defrauds his neighbor, they'll never come back. His point is that in a natural system of liberty, a free market, a butcher can just be thinking about the need that his daughter has for braces or the need he has to pay the rent. But to do that, as a butcher, successfully, he has to provide something for others that they will freely buy at a price they can afford and to do it better than his competitors. In other words, he attends to those things he cares and knows about, but the result of doing that in a market system is that it channels and orients his actions to the benefit of others. Right? Now, that is a radical insight. That there's an economic system that allows us to channel those legitimate needs and concerns we have in a way that doesn't just meet our own needs, but helps others. That's a remarkable insight. Now, it's a complicated issue. You could argue about it, but that's a different point than the one that Ayn Rand was making. That's the first point. Self-interest is not the same as selfishness. Here's the second one. Notice that when he's talking about the invisible hand, he says, in spite of. He's talking about business people. He says, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity. Doesn't say because of it. He never says it's a really good thing. You know, let, you know, sin increase that grace may be abundant or something like that. He doesn't say anything like that. He says in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity. And so in other words, Smith was a realist. He knew that human beings were fallen creatures. So you need an economic system that's appropriate to fallen human beings and not to angels. He said, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, in other words, even if they're selfish and rapacious, in a market economy, the best way for even a greedy butcher to get his needs met, even if all he cares about is making money, is to provide something for other people. So a market economy channels our legitimate self-interest as well as our vices in general into actions that benefit other people. At least they do that far more than any other economic system. Now, I hope you see that's it's a little complicated, but it is an amazing insight, and it's an amazing defense of the market economy, because in a socialist economy or crony economy, right, in which you're basically your instinct and your incentive is to try to get in thick with the regulators and the politicians so that they can do favors for you, right? If you're greedy, that's what you're going to do. You're not going to be channeling to help other people. You're going to be trying to get in thick with regulators. In a socialist economy, you just want to acquire power. But in a market economy, even if you're greedy, the best way to sort of fulfill that greed is to serve other people. That's a profound insight. And if you get that, you will never again fall for this idea that the market economy is based on greed. There's greed everywhere, but only certain economic arrangements allow that to happen. Well, third myth, what I call the zero-sum game myth. This zero-sum game comes from an area of study, sort of economics, called game theory. It's not a sort of complicated idea. And so a zero-sum game is just any game in which the rules of the game are set up so that for there to be a winner, there has to be a loser. So that's just the logic of the game. Right? Checkers is like this. Basketball is like this. Most of the games we're actually interested in playing are like this. For there to be a winner, there has to be a loser. Now, elementary school girls' soccer, at least, and other girls' sports in elementary school in Northern Virginia are not like this. They fudge the rules, and they're boring as a result. But that's most games are like that, right? They're win, lose, or zero-sum games. Zero-sum just means it's like 1 plus minus 1 sums to 0, right? So there are games like that, obviously. So if you think about this, okay, there's zero-sum games. That means there are going to be a couple other kind of games. There's going to be zero-sum or win-lose games. There's going to be lose-lose games. Those are games in which everybody that plays ends up worse off as a result of playing the game. These are not games that are played more than once, normally. You know, and it's actually hard to think of examples. Nuclear war in a confined space probably would qualify. Everybody ends up worse off as a result. So you've got a win-lose or zero-sum game. You've got lose-lose games. What's the third possibility? Win-win game. Now, what is that? A win-win game is a game in which everyone that plays ends up better off than they would have been if they hadn't played the game. And notice the way I say it. I didn't say everyone ends up equally well off. I said everyone that plays ends up better off than they would have been. Right? So if 10 of you go to a party, and it's like a casino party, and you all walk in with no money, and the guy that's hosting the party actually hands you all $10, and some of you win $1,000, and some of you win $10,000, and some of you win $100, and some of you just keep the $10, right? You all came with $0. So is that a win-win game? Yeah, that's a win-win game. Now, are you going to like it if you're one of the $10 winners? No, you're going to be irritated because you're sinful and greedy and envious and you want more. But you still are better off, right? And so a win-win game is just any game in which the rules are such that people that play it generally end up better off than they would have been. So what you want to do to say, am I in a win-win game, is not to say, you know, my neighbor has a Ferrari. That's evil and unfair. But what if you have a Volkswagen, right? Well, then, you know, you got to compare those things. And so when you're comparing these kind of games, you want to say, am I better off than I would have been if I hadn't played? And if you are, then you really don't have grounds for complaint. Okay, so this is the question. Is a market economy or a basic trade built into the system? Are the rules of the game such that if one person ends up winning, somebody has to lose? If one person gets rich from a trade, somebody else has to lose. Now, that's a really important idea, and it absolutely confounds people that get this into their heads, that if Peter is rich and has made a dollar, he can only have made a dollar by taking it from a Paul somewhere else. Right, this was sort of what was going on in the Occupy Wall Street movement. I actually went up to Zuccotti Park during this. The park, by the way, is about as big as this room. If you all remember the Occupy Wall Street crowd, this is a picture of one of the guys that was there. They all look more or less like that. It's a tiny park. There maybe could get 300 people in there, but if you get cameras set up the right way, it looks like the whole world is protesting. But it didn't actually succeed in doing anything, but they did get this idea of the 99% and the 1% into our language. And so then there were actual legitimate things that they were complaining about. It's just that they almost always had this sort of idea that 1% of the population is really rich, and as a result of that, it's left the rest of us in, you know, abject destitution or something. Now, it turns out a lot of the folks in Occupy Wall Street had graduate degrees and various things like that. In fact, there's one kid, it's a total side point, but I got to tell this story now, I've thought of it. There was one guy that was interviewed, I don't think it was him, but he looked kind of like him. And so this guy, he had racked up $60,000 in student loan debt, getting a master's degree in puppetry, all right? And so he was upset that the economy did not deliver to him a market in which people were willing to pay enough for puppetry that he could pay off his debt. Now, he might have wanted to think, what's the market for puppetry? And if you want to do it, that's fine. But so he was sort of mad at the universe because of this. But this is what we were dealing with. So we weren't even actually dealing with the really poor people for the most part. But what's funny is if you listen to them, they inevitably made this argument that our economy is a zero-sum game. A few people get really rich, and it causes everybody else to be poor as a result. Well, so here's the question. Is that true? And what's interesting about it is you can figure this question out purely by analyzing it. That's what, if you just think about the logic of a free exchange. And in fact, I knew the answer to this question when I was in the sixth grade. I just didn't figure it out until I was 40 and was thinking about it. I played a game, a teacher, you know, I grew up in a place kind of like Montana where it could be nice and sunny and then there's an ice storm suddenly, you know, the next day. And the teacher apparently had heard the news, and so she went to the store and bought a bunch of toys for the class, knowing we'd be stranded inside during recess. And so at recess, she handed out these toys to all of us in the classroom. And I assume there were 25 of us, five rows of five to simplify it. Handed out these toys, it was something different for everyone. So you had Silly Putty Egg and a six-pack or a 10-pack of Wrigley's gum and Barbie trading cards and paddle ball, stuff like that. Handed all out to us, said, okay, now look at your toy, look at everybody else's toy, write down on a piece of paper between 1 and 10 how much you like your toy in comparison to other people's. So we all, you looked around, I didn't get a great toy at the beginning. That's probably why I remember this. It was slightly traumatic. But we all looked, so you write down, okay, I like this much. And so then she had us call out the number we'd written on the piece of paper. Called it out, she added it up, and she wrote the total on the board. All right? And then she said, okay, now you can freely trade with anyone in your row. So that meant we all had four primary trading partners. Maybe two trades could happen, but there were four other people in the room we could trade with. And so there were actually quite a number of trades, right, that happened, but not that many. So some trades took place, said, okay, now write down how much you like the toy in your hand. Some kids had the same toy, right? Some had a new one. We did that. We called them out. She added up the total, wrote them on the board. You know what happened, right? The number went up. Now, this is just weird. This is one of the greatest mysteries of the universe. Remember, nothing new was added to the system. Same toys. So the second round, she said, now you can freely trade with anyone else in the classroom. 24 potential trading partners. And then if you know about Metcalfe's law that has to do with networking, that means there's an unbelievable number of possible multiple trades that could take place. You know, the kid in the back room that had never spoken all year is like, wait a second, suddenly kicks to attention to figure out, okay, how am I getting rid of the Barbie trading cards and getting the paddle ball? It was absolute pandemonium. A lot of trading took place, several minutes of it, finally settled down, said, okay, now write down how much you like the toy you have in your hand. We did, called out the numbers again, she added up the total, she wrote it on the board, and you know what happened. Number went way up, way up. Now, in fact, there are classes in college that use my book and play this game now, as I have discovered. And so I just thought it didn't seem like the most revolutionary thing at the time, but now it's like, gosh, this actually illustrates an interesting point. What's that point? The point is it actually is possible to set up a system of rules. Notice it's the rules. This isn't anarchy. Free trade is not me getting to, threaten the little girl behind me that she's going to give me her silly putty egg and I'm going to keep my toy. No, notice what happens. A free trade will only take place if both participants agree to it. right? So there are little win-win games happening everywhere. It constrains. There are things you can't do because of the rule of law that sets up opportunities for exchange. So even though the toys are added at the beginning, in a sense, new wealth is created simply by the exchange of the things. That's very, very strange. And lots of very smart people have not understood that. But free exchange, if it's truly free exchange, is a win-win game. And the wider the game is played, the more win-win exchanges are possible. I know that blows people's minds. It's often tempting to think, well, do we really benefit from trading with other countries? And often think, let's have tariffs and these things. No, and turns out that on balance, all things being equal, people, everyone ends up better off as a result of that. Now, notice that's just with trade. And this is why I think it's really important, and especially if you have kids in college, if some of you are in college, the way these things get set up is that people say, well, you've got the extremes are socialism on the one hand and capitalism on the other, and so what we want is a nice kind of middle way, right? And the middle way always ends up being socialism, unfortunately. You know, it's like it's very much like socialism. That's not the right comparison. The right comparison is anarchy, right? The law of the jungle, Lord of the Flies, on the one hand, and statism on the other hand, in which the state controls coercively everything. The golden mean between the extremes is free enterprise, in which there is rule of law, right, that prevents people from violating each other's rights, but then sets up the conditions for free exchange. That's a really important thing. The final myth I'll give you that's very much like the zero-sum game myth is called the materialist myth. The materialist myth is a belief not about trade, but about the nature of wealth. The materialist myth believes, it assumes, that wealth is not created but merely transferred from one person to the other. Right? And the sort of classic illustration of this is to think of the economy as a pie. And so, of course, everybody knows if actual earthly pie, like this crisscross cherry pie here, is that it's a fixed. There's a fixed amount. If you've got seven house guests coming over and you've got a pie, the best you can do is to cut it up equitably into eight equal slices, right? So everybody gets their fair share. Now, what if you want to eat a quarter of the pie? You're going to eat it before they come, right? Then you're going to make the slices small and spread it out so they can't see what happened, right? Because everybody knows you got more, they got less. It's a physical manifestation of a zero-sum game, right? Now, people often talk about this. They talk about, you know, a larger slice of the pie. They think of the economy in this way. Of course, everybody knows the economy is not like that. The economies grow. You know, the American and the Japanese economy after World War II, we both grew tremendously by trading with each other. One of us didn't get rich at the expense of the other. And so economically, we know that can't be right, but the metaphor is so powerful and so intuitive that we still think it anyway. And if you think it seems so primitive, it's important to realize that that little book I told you about at the beginning, The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, had exactly this vision of the economy in mind. Marx's entire argument is based on understanding the economy as a whole as a pie. Here's his basic argument. The Communist Manifesto said that capitalism, what they called capitalism, by the way, that's a socialist word. Marx is the one that popularized that word. So some say you probably shouldn't use the word, but that's sort of an aside. Here's their argument. They said capitalism will sow the seeds of its own destruction. Because what happens is the wealth of economy inevitably gets transferred from the workers or the proletariat to the capitalist or the owning class. So that over time, all the wealth is going to move into the hands of a few people. So here's the idea. I hope you all can see this. As I said, so it's sort of the beginning, what you have is you have a bunch of laborers who work, say they're the people that work in factories, and they're in the red here. And then you've got the capitalists who own the factories, the means of production. So what happens is, let's say, you know, I own a factory. I've got to hire workers, and I pay them as little as I have to in order to get them to work. They make shirts for me, let's say, and I take the shirts and I sell them in the market, and I try to sell them for more than they cost to produce, because if I do that, then I've made a profit, right? It's more than they cost to produce. Now, Marx thought, he believed in the labor theory of value, which meant he thought those shirts were worth only as much as it cost to produce them. So if this capitalist sold them for more than that, he was exploiting both the customer and the worker, called it surplus value. So he thought the very action was unjust. Nevertheless, he said, but capitalists, they don't squander their wealth in casinos. What they do is they take that profit and they reinvest it in their factories, in their equipment, and that makes the workers more productive. So as a result, those workers can produce more shirts for less money, can fire some of them because you don't need as many. You can pay the ones that are there even less than you did before. Then you can take those shirts, which you've produced less expensively, sell them for more, and now you've got even more profit. And then again, you reinvest it into the equipment. And then this process happens over and over. And so what happens is that all the wealth that starts out in the hands of the workers ends up in the hands of the capitalists at a time. So what this represents, the red is the amount of wealth in the hands of the workers. Okay, so it's not the number of workers. It's the amount of wealth in the economy at the beginning. Let's say it's England in 1800. So let's say 60% of the wealth in the economy in 1800 is in the hands of the workers. So they're going to work, but over time, what's going to happen is that the total amount of wealth is going to transfer to the green, into the hands of the capitalists. And the capitalists are actually just a few guys. And what happens is that they sort of monopolize and fuse and merge, and so you end up with just a few capitalists owning virtually all the wealth in the economy, and the laborers there in the red, 99% of the population owning virtually nothing. And so when this happens, what would you expect to occur? Revolution, right? Because you've got all these guys owning all this wealth and everybody else eking out a meager existence. So this is what Marx and Engels said, that capitalism will inevitably lead to revolution. And the workers will confiscate the means of production, and then the state will own everything, the means of production, on behalf of the people temporarily. And that'll be a temporary stop called socialism, which is, of course, gray, right? So this is, for Marx, this is just a temporary situation. And so people would get used to this. They wouldn't have private property. They wouldn't be attached to their belongings. And then the state would wither away, and milk and honey would flow in the streets, and you'd get this stateless sort of anarchic utopia. That was going to be communism. Now, it always got stuck here, right? And it got stuck because the whole theory is nonsense. That's not how the economy works. Steve Jobs did not get rich stealing iPads from homeless people, right? On Marx's theory, that's the only way it could have worked. There were all these iPads and iPods, right, and iPhones out there, started out in the hands of the workers, and he confiscates them over time. That makes absolutely no sense. Who's buying the darn things, right? But the workers. The whole thing's nonsense. And economists all know this is nonsense. But notice the whole argument's based on that materialist myth, which makes sense because Marx was a materialist. What do we know actually happens in markets? It's not a perfect utopian picture. There's bumps and ups and downs. There's entire industries that disappear and displace workers. But we know the market reality is that the pie grows, gets bigger over time. I know you're thinking, this is the most amazing PowerPoint animation I have ever seen. Look at this. It's just a series of different slides. You get the point, though, right? The pie grows. Now, why does this matter? It matters because what it means is that people in a market economy can get fabulously wealthy, not by confiscating wealth from other people, but by creating wealth for themselves and others. The pie grows, and so the whole argument falls apart. Now, here's where I find an interesting intersection with Christian theology. Economists know this is true, but as economists, it's very difficult to account for how wealth gets created. In fact, I tend to talk about land and labor and capital, and you know, it's a weird kind of thing. Economists have actually a very hard time accounting for this. As Christians, though, we know something about human beings that are often not recognized by economists. Human beings are the only things in the universe made in the image of the creative God. God is the creator of all that is. He sovereignly and freely calls into existence everything that exists. Right? And then on this sixth day of creation, there's this encore in which he creates these beings in his image and likeness. And what does he say? He says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Now that suggests to me textually that one aspect of being made in the image of God is that we exercise in a derivative way creative freedom that God has. We don't call things out into existence out of nothing. God creates sand, and he leaves it to us to create fiber optic cables and integrated circuits. Thomas Aquinas, the medieval theologian, said, God grants to creatures the dignity of causality. In other words, he doesn't hoard all the ability to cause and to create in himself. He creates little causes that can themselves cause and create things. And so human beings can transform the material world God has created into resources, into wealth. And that, I think, is a very optimistic and hopeful thought. Thank you very much. Are you going to do questions?